ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife. News breakdown.
Time for Nightlife News Breakdown. Well, it's hardly a surprise, I would think. The National Party have now formally dropped a commitment to reach net zero emissions by 2050 after a unanimous party room decision yesterday. The move sets up a possible showdown with the Liberal Party, though. Moderate Liberal MPs are wanting to maintain the net zero targets. After all, they might think, hang on, these were set when Scott Morrison was Prime Minister, and they were agreed upon by the Nationals then. So they see them as having some voter appeal. In fact, one of the only paths they need to tread to get back to government. Nationals leader David Littleproud is now having to refute that the Nationals are climate change deniers. He says no, the party's policy will instead target a reduction of 30 to 40% by 2035. That's half of Labor's commitment, and they'll focus on climate adaptation, prioritising energy costs, rebooting the Emissions Reduction Fund for investment, lifting the nuclear power ban and bringing back coal and so on. This is David Littleproud on the decision.
Net zero is not the only way to address climate change. And when you talk about adaptation, you should do the practical things that we haven't been doing in a stronger environment, investment in a stronger environment. And so this is about a common sense solution.
Well, the Nationals' position does put a lot of pressure on the coalition leader, Susan Lee, to come up with a cogent and electorally appealing climate policy. The challenge being, do the Liberals also drop the target or stick by it and risk splitting the coalition if a consensus can't be reached? David Littleproud says he'll stand back and let the Liberals work out their own position.
That'll be a decision for the Liberal Party. The Liberal Party respected us and didn't tell us how we should have our policy, and I don't intend to do that. I'm going to allow them to get to that position under their own volition.
Susan Lee, trying to keep the peace, I suppose, had a positive take on the Nationals' decision.
They're entitled as their own party to arrive at their own position, and David Littleproud made that clear yesterday, and we had a very convivial conversation about next steps in a process, and I'm looking forward to the work that will happen between now and the Liberal Party's position becoming known.
Yes, but if the Liberals now also drop net zero, how is that going to look? The Nationals' tail wagging the senior coalition partner dog. Is that what the situation is? Anyway, joining us for tonight's Nightlife News Breakdown, we're joined by Emily Barrett, Managing Editor of the Saturday Paper. Emily, good evening to you. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Good evening, Phil. Thanks for having me.
Now, Susan Lee saying things are all very convivial. Wasn't so long ago after the federal election, the national split from the coalition and the bond between the two parties census seemed pretty tentative. I mean, this would seem to be more of the same, doesn't it? How serious do you assess that it is for Susan Lee?
Yeah, well, I mean, it doesn't sound great when you're saying things like, you know, between now and the Liberal Party's position becoming known, it sounds as if she's a little bit adrift herself. And I think that's where the questions of leadership are really sort of the rubber's hitting the road there, because it's pretty serious, really, that the coalition's obviously fairly unbreachable. Policy differences are still the main story. We're 6 months after the election. And Lee doesn't want to preside over a broken opposition, obviously, but, you know, the fractures that are obvious both within her own party, that's with Hastie and Jacinta Price now on the backbench, and with the Nationals, these aren't things that she can kind of paper over, no matter how much she's trying. And you know, the attempts that she's made over the past couple of weeks to try and seize the agenda and kind of soothe the right faction of the party, they just don't seem to have got her very far. You know, that proposal to split the EPC reform bill and the sort of bizarre attack on Albanese's T-shirt, it's left her conspicuously unsupported by her own party. So, you know, obviously we've had those reports now from the AFR and from a couple of other outlets saying that Liberals are actually on the verge of dropping the commitment to net zero themselves. You know, this is based on some meetings with the Conservative members of the shadow cabinet. And it's just really, you know, if she does do that, it's just another repeat of the pattern that arguably, you know, really lost in the last election, because Dutton allowed the Nationals to basically dictate coalition policy.
Yeah, well, I mean, how's it going to look if they drop it now, given that it's going to look as though the Nationals have led the way here, isn't it? And is that a situation she wants to be in? I would wonder.
That was the path to losing pretty much all of their urban seats. So it would be a colossal cave-in to save her leadership, and that's, you know, for however long that works.
Yes, exactly. Susan's thinking that all things are very convivial, but you do wonder about the national strategy here too, Emily. I mean, who might benefit from their position of dropping net zero? Former Labor strategist Cos Samaras. He's now a Director of Strategy and Analytics at the research firm Redbridge. Watches the numbers closely in the trends when it comes to votes and politics in different electorates. Here he is today.
The Liberal Party's got a really big problem now, and that is the politics which may work in National Party electorates no longer work in the large cities of our country. It's within these large cities where the coalition needs to win seats, where the Liberal Party in particular needs to win seats and needs to start talking to an emerging and dominant generation of voters who will be in excess of 50% at the next election, that is millennial and Gen Z, in large cities such as Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane and so on.
Even more so in two elections' time, when probably it's more realistic that the coalition, if they got their act together, could challenge for the government benches again. You do wonder who the decision makers in the Nationals are listening to, Emily.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this is the continuing question, right? It doesn't sound as if they're listening to their constituents, like the Centre for Independent Studies. I mean, you know, we saw reports last week, that the Conservative think tank was telling coalition MPs that heat death's under thing. And, you know, if you look at the polls, Essential Poll says that among Australians in general, 44% of Australians want net zero targets and 29% 27% are opposed to it. So, and then if you break it down to just coalition supporters, they say almost half want more progressive positions for the coalition and only 29% want it to move further to the right. So, you know, they're talking about net zero as if it's a kind of a compromise. You know, they want to, you know, they believe in reducing emissions but not at any cost, and they want to do it cheaper. Mm. And, you know, all this leaning into adaptation. But the truth is that, you know, of course, the longer we fail to act, the more costly, the more potentially ineffective the measures that need to be taken. So it's a fairly cynical kind of approach, as we know.
Yes, I mean, whatever. And there are legitimate prices about, you know, the cost of energy and the cost of living. Absolutely legitimate questions to be asked about that. But is going backwards, which essentially what the Nats are suggesting, is that the way forward? You do wonder. You wonder sometimes whether it is time that the coalition did split. Well, they did, immediately after the election, didn't they? It's certainly the view of a number of people, including one behind-the-scenes player in Australian politics, albeit a progressive player, businessman and Climate 200 co-convener Simon Holmes at Court. He says it's time the Liberals separated themselves from the Nats.
Well, the Nationals are the tail that's wagging the Liberal dog, and that tail is gangrenous. Any competent vet would advise you've got to cut it off before it kills the dog. So whether it stays together or they part ways, the coalition as we knew it is dead.
I wonder whether he has a point. I mean, I listened to a number of commentators throughout the day too who suggest that Susan Lee's already shaky hold in the Liberal Party leadership is on the brink. Is that how you read it?
Well, I mean, look, you don't even have to look that far beyond the coalition to sometimes a court to get the view that he was just expressing. You know, we've got this pretty heavy imagery coming, you know, in the Australian newspaper this morning. We had a Liberal MP describing Nationals as terrorists and, you know, the first rule of being a parasite is not to kill your host. It's pretty strong language. So, you know, I guess it's clear that Susan Lee is struggling. Her approval rating right now is worse than Peter Dutton ever had. That's judged by the latest news poll. So, you know, they had this moment there was a victory on aged care packages. They had a moment of respite, and that was overshadowed by having to move Jacinda Price to the backbench. She doesn't seem to have got strong enough support from the moderates within her camp, like Andrew Bragg, to stand up the Conservatives. So, you know, you can imagine that those moderates must be getting more and more frustrated. They're saying some pretty strong things, certainly to the media. So, you know, it is a wonder, and, you know, it's not surprising that Simon Holmes at Court is finding that interesting watching.
Yes, exactly. All right. But the way forward for the Liberals is to win back city seats. They don't have any at the moment. They need to win them.
No, right.
And it's amazing. Do you win them by adopting a kind of what looks like climate-denying approach? I don't know. Anyway, look, staying with climate matters, this year's fortnight-long Global Climate Summit, aka also known as COP30, COP, the Conference of the Parties, officially starts today week in the Brazilian city of Belém, although international leaders are gathering in advance, some arriving on Thursday. Britain's Keir Starmer, France's Emmanuel Macron, Germany's Friedrich Merz, Palau Sir Angel Whips Jr. are heading there. It's being hosted by the Brazilian President Lula da Silva, to focus on the faltering work to deliver on the goals of the 2015 Paris Agreement. Is Mr. Albanese going? The Prime Minister has not confirmed his attendance. He hasn't attended a UN climate conference since becoming PM. There were doubts that he would attend. After all, he's now said he's prepared to travel to the conference to try and win the rights to host next year's COP summit. Both Australia and Turkey want to host the event, but unless the countries can agree, it's going to end up in Germany. This is the Prime Minister today.
I've written to the President Erdogan. I'm available, and we want to talk these issues through. I've said I'm certainly prepared to travel, including to Belém, if that makes a difference.
He's had a lot of travel in recent weeks, since late September, visiting the US twice, and he's just returned from Malaysia and South Korea. He heads to South Africa in 3 weeks for the G20. What are the chances, do you think, that he will? I mean, he probably will only go to this COP meeting if he's guaranteed that Australia will host this next in Adelaide next year, isn't he?
I mean, maybe he's worried about his carbon footprint. I'm not sure. You'd have to think it would be helpful to Australia's prospects for co-hosting the next one with the Pacific Islands to actually show up. Certainly there is the 28 members of the Western Europe and other states group that's supposed to be deciding this is going to be meeting throughout this week. We've got a junior minister, Josh Wilson, who's going as Assistant Minister for Climate Change and Energy. Chris Bowen is not going to be there until later. So it does look like the behaviour of leaders who are avoiding perhaps a not very favourable announcement. But if it's not decided in favour of either Australia or Turkey this month, then it will go to Bonn. And the Germans, the point is the Germans have said already they don't want a host.
It's getting a bit late for Australia to host too, isn't it?
Quite right.
How are they possibly going to organise it all by November next year when it's on?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm sure that hopefully there's enough in train to get that started from a running start already. But it doesn't look good if the Prime Minister hasn't got a response from Erdogan. He was trying to meet with him in New York in September, and apparently that one didn't go so well. So, unless there's some kind of 11th hour turnaround, it's not looking great for Adelaide.
I don't know whether it'd be a good thing or not. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people would think, do we need another big meeting in Adelaide? I don't know.
But I
suppose the main thing is it egg on the government's face here if in the end the COP doesn't go to Adelaide?
Yeah, well, I think it's difficult in terms of the co-hosting had some benefits sort of stitched into it, because there was a chance to really show to Pacific co-hosts that Australia was, serious about this, that has diplomacy ramifications, in terms of our negotiations across the Pacific region in competition with China. There are things about successful hosting here that would have been positive, no doubt, and certainly Bowen was leaving no stones unturned to try and make it work, by all accounts. So it would be embarrassing, and it would be a setback, really. Mm. Although, of course, there are enough people who were saying, how could we host when we're still doing things like approving projects like the Northwest Shelf Extension. So there's a degree of sort of complaints about the hypocrisy of the stance that the government's been taking, as well as sort of worrying about what we don't.
Oh, well, it's not an area where anybody can speak with a pure and untainted voice, I suspect.
Yeah, very true.
Optus under scrutiny in the Senate. The Optus executives face some pretty tough questioning at a Senate inquiry today. It's been all over the news, pretty much, for their sort of response to the September 000 outage. Chief Executive Stephen Roo was the main target in the firing line. He blamed staff carrying out welfare checks for the telco taking so long a time to inform the government that people had died during the outage. Now, The Senate heard that Optus had learned two people had died by 9:30pm on September the 18th and had alerted senior management 3 hours later, but it took until 2:30 the next day for Optus to pass on this information to the Australian Government's Communications and Media Authority. Sarah Henderson, a former Shadow Communications spokesperson, says the delay was far too long.
The CEO sat on his hands and for many hours didn't inform ACMA, the regulator, and the Minister's office about the true scale of the catastrophe.
Yes, well, it's Senator Hanson-Young, the Green Senator, also had a field day of sorts too, interrogating Stephen Rue. Emily, Optus has made significant changes to the procedures, but the whole episode in the Senate questioning does raise the question of how adequate the whole system is, doesn't it?
Oh, it does to some extent. I mean, it's certainly worth looking into. We're coming up to another season of extreme weather, as seems to be more and more regular. But, you know, it doesn't look great. The inquiry that heard today that Optus, this headline had come out, you know, 11 crisis meetings before telling the government about the deaths. It doesn't look good. It came about, this entire investigation, you know, not only on what Optus had done, but this concern from the Greens and the Coalition that, you know, there really needed to be some shoring up of the emergency response systems more generally. But, you know, obviously Stephen Rue was really taking the heat today and he's still resisting calls to resign. He's apologised to the inquiry. And they do have these procedures in place that he was describing in some detail today, you know, new mandatory escalation procedures to alert of any 000 problems that customers report. Also, you know, monitoring of call failure rates and volumes that's supposed to be 24/7, and a new daily emergency call reliability testing regime in every state and territory. So they're taking clear steps to try and address what has been a considerable failure. And you know, hopefully that really does help to make the system more secure.
Let's hope so. Now, just finally, Emily, I'm not sure if you marked Halloween last Friday.
Absolutely, yes.
Correct, nice, good.
More children.
Ah, well, children of Chesney as well. If you, that's right, they will lead the way here. But in America, of course, where we think most of it's imported from, although it probably it's not at the... Its foundation, of course, was in Europe, of course. But as 42 million Americans lost their federal food stamps thanks to a government shutdown, things are tough. No sign of the shutdown ending. US President Donald Trump celebrated Halloween with a big, roaring 20s-themed party at his Mar-a-Lago estate. Now, why is this interesting? Because, well... I mean, for various reasons, I suppose, but also two prominent Australians were included in the guest list at Mar-a-Lago. One Nation leader, Pauline Hanson, was apparently there, and also mining magnate Gina Rinehart. Well, Gina Rinehart's been there before. What's the story? What's the story here, Emily? Is Pauline Hanson getting on the MAGA bandwagon, or what's going on?
Well, I mean, yes, I suppose that would be the implication. I mean, to be clear, there's been no confirmation from Pauline Hanson's camp that she was actually in attendance, although she is in the US apparently at the moment. And there seem to be some, you know, sort of sympathies of particularly stances on immigration, perhaps between the MAGA teams and that of Pauline Hanson. But, you know, I mean, you've made the point, it's pretty on the nose considering that the government shutdown has actually, you know, put a stop to some food assistance programs in the US. This kind of Great Gatsby party, you know, it's kind of showing that the point of the work was more or less lost on the people there. There's we do have a photo from Instagram of Gina Rinehart basically at the party leaning over Trump's shoulder and looking fairly engaged in some piece of paperwork. And it's not, as we've said, it's not the first time she's attended a Mar-a-Lago event, but it's clear from this sort of imagery that she's very much got the president's ear, at least to some extent. And, you know, this is coming in the wake of this critical minerals deal, you know, this multi-billion dollar deal that both Albanese and the president signed last month. And that was interestingly included in that deal was the government's pledge to take an equity stake in Arafura Rare Earths. And that's it's mining those resources in the Northern Territory. And Hancock Prospecting, which is, of course, Gina Rinehart's company, has tipped $125 million into that project. So she's taking, as Mike Seckham wrote for us last week or on the weekend, she's taken stakes in about a half a dozen companies in the critical minerals and rare earths area, and their value has tripled this year. So she's definitely got onto the sort of ride of what this sort of geopolitical arrangement now is, and clearly she's at the front seat.
Yeah. Watch this space, people. All right. Emily, terrific to talk with you, as always. Thank you.
Great to talk to you too. Thanks a lot, Phil.
Emily Barrett, the Managing Editor of the Saturday Paper, leading the Nightlife News Breakdown for us tonight.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.